Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization that provides disaster relief across the globe, from responding to earthquakes in Haiti to hurricanes in New York City. Team Rubicon is a group of veterans who are applying the skills they used in war zones, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, to disaster situations elsewhere. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What does Team Rubicon do?
So, you know, Team Rubicon is really focused on taking veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and finding a way for them to continue to serve. And, you know, what we do is we organize, train, and deploy them for disaster relief. You know, we found a lot of lessons that were learned on the battlefield are applicable in disaster zones, and we feel like there's a lot of synergy there that can, you know, benefit from both sides.
Now, the catalyst for starting the organization was the earthquake in Haiti in January 2010. Where were you at that time?
You know, I had just gotten out of the Marine Corps, and I'd been out of the Marine Corps for about 3 months. I was living in Los Angeles. I'd been stationed in Southern California. That's what took me out there. And I was applying to go to grad school to get my MBA and was sitting on my couch in my apartment in Los Angeles when the earthquake happened. The joke is that I was sitting around in my underwear eating, you know, potato chips when it happened. And there's some truth to that, probably.
Now, you joke about, you know, being alone on your couch eating potato chips, but a lot of the experience of soldiers coming back from war is isolated and lonely. What was your personal experience being back?
Right. I mean, if I was alone eating potato chips on my couch when this happened, it wasn't because I was, you know, isolated and withdrawn socially after having come out of the military. It's not really fair to ask how my experience was coming out because, you know, in 3 months, it's very hard to determine. I got out of the Marine Corps. My then-girlfriend, now wife, and I went to South America for, you know, a month and traveled South America. And I came back and it was the holidays and I was having fun and I was seeing family and friends. And so, you know, early January, I hadn't even thought about life as a civilian yet. And so then I went straight into Team Rubicon. I went straight to Haiti. And, you know, my wife jokes that I really never left, you know, the military. So it's kind of my experience transitioning out has been far from normal.
In a positive sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
When she jokes that you really have never left the military, how much of your wanting to go to Haiti was personally driven about, like, wanting to be back where you had been because of the adrenaline rush and the other things that go along with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to think back to what the emotions were that were going through that day. You know, I've always been the type of person that's wanted to help people. You know, that was one of my motivations for joining the military in the beginning. But, you know, I'd be a liar if I said there wasn't an element of excitement to it. There was a certain level of, you know, the rush. And you know, I still miss that. You know, whenever missions happen, I long for it, you know, and to be where the boots hit the ground.
So you see the earthquake in Haiti and you said, okay, I want to respond. What logistically did you do?
William and I had a couple of initial phone calls about what needed to happen in order to make it a reality.
And by the way, William McNulty, your co-founder.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so we had a couple of initial conversations. Of course, the first thing we had to do was get down to Haiti, you know, and that was problematic because they shut down the airport and only military planes were coming in and humanitarian designated planes. So we needed to raise money, get to Haiti, and then we needed, you know, shelter, food, and water. I mean, some of the basic necessities of doing anything in life. And so we were able to raise the money initially from social media.
Now, when you say social media, you posted your desire on Facebook?
Yeah, basically, once the decision was made, we put it to Facebook, which I guess, you know, nothing's official these days until it's on Facebook. And within, I'd say, 10 minutes, my future brother-in-law called me and offered to buy 4 round-trip tickets down to the Dominican Republic, which is where we had kind of decided we had to fly in and out of, as you know, because of this restricted airspace in Port-au-Prince. So that kind of made it a reality. We knew we could get, we may not be able to get to C, if C is Port-au-Prince, but we could get to B, which was right next door in the Dominican Republic.
So, and is that a military term, using those letters like that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm a big believer in you'll never get anywhere looking for the complete solution. You know, you always have to put yourself closer and closer to the problem, finding those incremental, you know, solutions. And so we knew we could get to the Dominican Republic, and at first we didn't know how we were going to get to the Dominican, from the Dominican to Haiti, but once you start putting those pieces in place, those other solutions, it opens doors. The next thing was, okay, security and where are we going to lay our head at night? And William went to a Jesuit high school in Chicago. For whatever reason, he thought it'd be a good idea to call someone at his former Jesuit high school. And it turns out it was a good idea. And we got put in touch with the Jesuits who were running a mission down in Port-au-Prince. And so we had a Jesuit brother, Brother Jim, drive from Port-au-Prince across the border and met us in the Santo Domingo, and then escorted us back into Haiti, over land.
So how much planning did you do from your couch in Los Angeles versus just learning by doing once you got down there?
We were probably, from the time we made the decision to go to the time we boarded planes to leave, was about 48 hours. You know, a lot of that was packing supplies and continuing to raise some money and set some of those things in place. And
how many were you?
Well, it started out with four. And en route down to the Dominican, we each recruited another member to the team while we were flying down. So William, for instance, was sitting on the tarmac at Dulles Airport. And a guy leans over and says, "Hey, you look like you're about to go do something crazy in Haiti." And William, you know, was kind of taken aback, but he said, "Yeah, you're right. I'm going down." And he goes, "Oh, I was a former Army Special Forces medic. You know, I've got experience in Haiti working for a security company, and I'm going down there to help myself. Mind if I join?" And so we added that guy, Mark Hayward. And then I added an ER doctor that I met in Santo Domingo at the baggage claim. And it just kind of rolled up from there.
How were you received? Did you ask permission from certain organizations before you went down?
Yeah. So again, William, you know, kept making a lot of pieces fall in place. He was in D.C. when this all was going down. And, you know, in those 48 hours that we were preparing, he just walked up to both the Dominican and the Haitian embassies on Embassy Row and probably oversold what it was that we were doing and capable of. But he got signed letters from both ambassadors to the U.S. guaranteeing, you know, the safe passage across the border and that none of our supplies were to be confiscated or anything like that. And so, yes, technically we were invited and we had these permissions. I think that we probably took advantage of the, you know, the chaos of the situation a little bit.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. When did it occur to you that the situation in Haiti resembled the disaster situations, the ambiguity, the human tragedy, the mismanagement that you had experienced out in the field in the war zone?
I mean, from the moment we crossed the border checkpoint was complete chaos. There was really no control happening. You could just pass and go as you saw fit. But as you got closer and closer and closer to Port-au-Prince, the density of suffering just increased. There was just still this dust in the air from all the rubble. And it was literally like a fog, but it was this chalky dust. And you could still hear people crying and wailing. And we were in pickup trucks at that point and moving 6 miles an hour through these streets, people coming up and trying to pull supplies off of the back of your truck. And we were getting in there right at twilight, and so it was about to go dark. We made it to the compound right as the sun went down, and we rolled into this Jesuit compound. They had a guard at the door with a shotgun, and you know, we did a quick perimeter check to see how secure it was, and we bedded down for the night. But shortly after arriving and starting to bed down, one of the doctors that had joined the team was approached, and there was a woman or a little girl with her mother who had an open and compound fracture in her leg, you know, meaning that her femur had broken so badly that the bone was coming out through the skin. And it had been like that, of course, for 4 days. So 20 minutes after arriving, our doctors were doing, you know, basic battlefield surgery almost, and without anesthesia. This poor girl was sitting there and she was screaming and wailing, and that was kind of a welcome to Port-au-Prince.
You were kind of struck by the similarity in the Middle East, but how much was the fact that your life was not at risk to the same degree part of your experience? Like,
yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I was in the Marine Corps Infantry for one tour with a rifle squad in Anbar Province, Iraq during the surge. Saw the full range of kinetic activity that a Marine rifle squad can experience. My second tour, I was a scout sniper on a sniper team in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, which was the most volatile area of Afghanistan for the last, really, for the last 4 years. So I'd been in danger. You know, I'd been in mortal danger for pretty much the prior 4 years of my life. So it was interesting to be in an area where there was so much need for help and a similar need and in many ways similar, you know, sensory activity with smells and sights and sounds and all of that, but not having to feel like there was an ambush around every corner. I mean, there was danger. There's a lot of criminal activity in Port-au-Prince. It's a very dangerous city. Nobody's going there for holidays, but I mean, it was relieving. I think my friend Clay kind of said it best. He talked about how it was renewed his sense of humanity a little bit, you know, even in a place like Port-au-Prince, which on a normal day is pretty dangerous. You know, the worst catastrophe in modern history befalls them and they become more human. They're helping one another. They're putting down grudges and longstanding rivalries to help dig each other out or provide water and food for one another. And we're gracious to our help.
By the way, William, your co-founder, William McNulty, how did you meet him?
Hey, we always joke about how it was kind of like Match.com. You know, we had been put in touch with one another about a year prior to the earthquake. We had never met, kind of had a mutual acquaintance who thought that we kind of thought alike. You know, we had only had some cursory conversations prior to Haiti. So Santo Domingo, Dominican, was the first time we ever shook hands.
Yet he was the first person you called to want to get down there.
Well, he actually called me. So it's kind of a funny story. I went through, initially I called all the guys that had been in my sniper team in Afghanistan. And either they hadn't yet figured out that there was an earthquake that hit Port-au-Prince, or they didn't have a passport. The irony of being able to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan is you don't need a passport. I was dumbfounded that they either didn't know what was going on and I had to yell at them to turn on the TV and turn it to CNN for once in their lives, or they didn't have a passport. Actually, the first person I got a hold of was my college roommate, who was the firefighter up in Wisconsin. He didn't hesitate to say that you know, he was willing to go. And then after I put it on Facebook, I got a call from William.
Isn't it interesting how, you know, these accidents happen?
Right.
The accident of your co-founding Team Rubicon was through, you know, an introduction by a friend.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes you can't discount some of those, you know, those minor events that happen. You know, one of our mantras early at TR was to, you know, never say no. You know, say yes to everything because you never know who's going to play out and help or be a critical, you know, component of the team moving forward.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon. We'll hear more from Jake coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. And by the way, the organization now is comprised of not just veterans, but other volunteers. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we have about 80% of our volunteers are veterans. The other 20 are a lot of firefighters, you know, some doctors and medics and first responders, and you know, a few well-meaning civilians slip in as well.
At what point did you decide to formalize or institutionalize the organization after Haiti?
You know, the whole story is just really funny. We had no intention of starting an organization when we went down to Haiti. Just wanted to go and help. We thought it was something that we'd, you know, tell at the bar, you know, as a one-upper story for the rest of our lives. But you know, while we were down there, we started to see the impact we could have, but I still don't think it really hit us. But you know, we had kind of a sensationalist story. This group of military veterans running around Port-au-Prince, you know, outside the big UN cluster system, and providing a lot of real meaningful aid in a very transparent way, and using social media to tell that story. So we started to get this really large following online out of nowhere overnight. And that propelled a lot of money to come in. And so my dad took a week off of work. He's you know, the vice president of manufacturing for a, you know, small factory up in Iowa. And he was running our command operations center from our house in Iowa.
What's his name?
Jeff Wood. So we were raising this money, and I'd have a weekly or a nightly or every other night phone call with my dad to check in and see, okay, hey, we have more teams coming down from Chicago. They're arriving at noon tomorrow. We have these pieces coming in from Miami and supplies coming in from Pittsburgh. And there was a lot of moving pieces that really, you know, snowballed. And one night my dad called me and we kind of went through the general brief that we'd been going through. And then he said, oh, by the way, I got a phone call from a lawyer who was a former Marine up in Minnesota. And he just incorporated you today as a 501c3. And I said, Dad, what the hell is a 501c3? I had no idea. And he said, it's a nonprofit organization and you're the president. I said, well, that's not in the plan. Why? And he said, well, because of all the money that's been raised, it was through my personal PayPal account. And I was going to be liable for taxes and all these things. And so the IRS, to their credit, did a great job of realizing that this was such an out of the ordinary event that they were very good about allowing organizations that kind of popped up to, you know, retroactively give charitable credit for donations that came in before those 501c3 paperwork was established. So, I mean, the IRS actually did a really good job post-Haiti of being flexible, yeah, which they're not exactly known for. So that's how we found ourselves, William and I, on the board of directors for a nonprofit that didn't exist, you know, 12 hours before the Haiti earthquake.
And how did you come to the name?
Right before we pushed out to Port-au-Prince, William called me and said, I think we should give this a name. It's starting to get a little traction, and Marines always want to name everything that they do. So we started bouncing it back and forth, but the Rubicon was a river that separated ancient Rome and Gaul, and Roman legions weren't allowed to cross it because it was considered an act of war. Crossing the Rubicon has come to mean the point of no return, or crossing to the point of no return. And there's a river that separates part of the Dominican from Haiti as a border. And so we kind of treated that border crossing as our Rubicon. There were no longer any excuses. There were a ton of excuses for us not to go all along the way that people were telling us, all these reasons. But we knew that as soon as we crossed that border, we were going to be committed.
By the way, you mentioned before that one of your mantras or rules was never say no.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah, I mean, that more had to do with, like, meeting people and you know, take this meeting or meet that person for coffee, even if it didn't seem to make sense. We say no a lot, just to get that clear.
And so how is that applied in your personal life? Do you tend to have a posture of openness?
Yeah. You know, I've always been a really forward-leaning person. You know, a lot of people, they find reasons not to do something, or they see obstacles instead of opportunities. And we took this position of we will meet with every single person that we can. And it doesn't matter if they're, you know, selling, you know, pink lemonade in Philadelphia. If they ask us to go out for coffee, we're going to do it.
We talk about the Rubicon and you're having a forward-leaning posture. What for you was the reason to go into a life in the military? You don't have family in the military.
I'd always been interested in the military in high school and was thinking about joining then. And turned out I was a decent high school football player. And so I started getting a lot of scholarship opportunities to go and play college football. And that shifted my priorities a little bit, and I wanted to go be a pro football player. And so
you went to the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, so I ended up taking a full scholarship to the University of Wisconsin instead of going to either a military academy or just joining the Marines right out of high school, which had always kind of been a plan of mine. And so I went to college fall of 2001, and 6 weeks in or 4 weeks into college freshman classes, 9/11 happened. I thought about dropping out, you know, a month into college and joining. I didn't. I made excuses not to go. And over the course of the next 2 years, my college career didn't pan out from a football perspective like I'd hoped. And then going into my senior year, Pat Tillman was killed in Afghanistan, who had been a pro football player that walked away from $9 million to join the Army. That profoundly impacted my life. And so I made the decision the day I saw the ticker come across the screen that he'd been killed, that I was going to join.
And here's somebody who played football in college and who sold life insurance one summer.
Me?
Right? Yeah.
How the hell do you know that? That actually paid enormous dividends.
Tell me how selling life insurance paid enormous dividends.
You know, there is not a harder sales gig in the world than selling life insurance. But it's paid a lot of dividends.
Why do you keep saying that? Why?
Well, I mean, my whole it's equally difficult to try to get people to invest in a startup nonprofit where they're never going to see their money come back. And that's really what we were. In essence, I had to go to angel investors and say, hey, write me a check for $50,000 for this idea called Team Rubicon. The only promise I have is that you'll never see your money again. You know, even in the social sector, foundations are not quick to write checks to organizations less than 3 years old. And a lot of them, you know, saw Team Rubicon as a flash in the pan, one-hit wonder from Haiti, and didn't think that we'd 50 missions later be, you know, still kicking ass. So.
You mentioned before your friend Clay. You were his best man at his wedding. He was a former Marine. Mm-hmm. And after the war, he took his life in 2011 due to this difficult transition to civilian life. And there's a quote he said, "Marines are at war and Americans are at the mall." Mm-hmm. To what extent is Team Rubicon a place for former veterans to go to have a sense of purpose, to be able to make themselves useful?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it's all about now. Over the first year, we thought the organization was just going to be a disaster response organization. But what we saw was that these veterans who were participating in that were coming home and saying that it was, you know, the most valuable experience that they'd had since they took off their uniform. And concurrent to that, we had a lot of veterans who were asking to get involved with Team Rubicon who, for whatever reason, they didn't have the necessary skill set to go, say, and train medics in Burma, you know, along the Thai-Burma border. Maybe they were a truck driver in the military or a nuclear biochemical specialist in the Navy, and we just didn't need that. But they were expressing this desire to be a part of something again. And so, you know, right around this time is when Clay killed himself, and we realized that there was this opportunity for us to become more than just a disaster response organization, but to be an organization that provides purpose and community and, you know, identity for veterans who are longing for that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. There's a company called Palantir, which addresses big data mm-hmm. and helping organizations and companies sift through just large information. How are you using Palantir at Team Rubicon?
Yeah, so Palantir is actually one of those just never say no stories. I was speaking at an event in San Diego, and after the event, I got approached by this guy named Brian Fishman, who worked on their philanthropy team. And he approached me, reached out, shook my hand, said, great talk. And anyway, we have a great talk. The guy's very genuine. And over the course of the next 4 weeks, we had some, you know, some just high-level discussions about what Palantir might do for us. And I just still didn't get it. Mm. Then Hurricane Sandy happened, maybe a month and a half after we had met. And he calls me, and he just keeps calling me and calling me three times a day during the first 5 days of that response. And I'm actually pretty frustrated that he's continuing to bother me. And he just keeps saying, like, let us go to New York, and I'll show you what we can do. And I said, fly to JFK, be there by 9 p.m., I'll have a van pick you up, bring all the equipment you need, don't screw it up, you know, or something like that. And he showed up, and, you know, when they land and they show up at our forward operating base, I get a phone call from our team leader on the ground. He goes, who are these geeks? And he didn't get it either. And, you know, listen, fast forward 48 hours, Brian Fishman and this team of engineers from Palantir start making us look like the smartest guys in the room. And it's only because we just didn't say no, although we were tempted to.
So what exactly do they do?
I didn't even get to the question. So we will go into a disaster zone with a bunch of mobile devices. So we send out these assessment teams immediately after a tornado, say. And they go street by street, house by house, and they are inputting information into this mobile device. So we might go through a neighborhood, two different neighborhoods, and one has suffered catastrophic damage and one has suffered medium scale damage, but both are uninhabitable. You might say that go after the catastrophic damage first because it's worse damage. It's going to take more work. But if we layer in, say, U.S. Census data, which Palantir can do, and then heat map the levels of damage against, say, elderly populations or poverty levels, then we can say, well, actually, although the damage is less significant over here in this neighborhood, this is a more vulnerable population, so we need to pour resources here first because they're not going to be able to get back onto their feet as easy. This will bankrupt them if they don't come in and get free yet professional labor.
I want to shift to your personal life. You mentioned that you grew up in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Your father is a vice president at a manufacturing company. Mm-hmm. What does he manufacture?
They manufacture laboratory equipment, specifically calorimeters, so devices that measure energy output. So you put, like, say, food in it, and you put it, make it, you pump oxygen, and then you burn it, and it measures the caloric output of it.
Caloric,
no. Like calories.
And your mom?
My mom has been a stay-at-home mom my whole life. I've been very lucky.
How many siblings do you have?
I've got three sisters, two older and one younger.
What was your family's response when you told them that you wanted to go into the military, into the Marines?
They were devastated. Take, for instance, my dad. I think he was, to be blunt, I think he was a little pissed off. I certainly know now he understands.
What has surprised you about your Team Rubicon experience, like running the organization? And also, what has surprised you about your experience just like being out there on the ground?
Boy, there's a couple things that jump out at me. I think on the international side, there's this aversion to anything not humanitarian. And so that means that there are all these humanitarian organizations that that loathe Team Rubicon because of our military roots. Mm-hmm. They have a natural mistrust of the military. And coupled with that, you know, there's a lot of business practices, best practices that just, for whatever reason, whether they have the same poor opinion of big business, but they just refuse to adopt. And you would think that there would be, you know, just simple things like the adoption of universal cloud computing platforms that would enable a cluster in Manila and a cluster in Tacloban to have access to the same information in real time. But there isn't. And it's and you have these people that are handing in paper forms with information on different formats that get taken in, and then nothing happens with it. Nobody collates it. Nobody uploads it to the cloud for universal access. Nobody's certainly mapping it geospatially. And these are things that the military has been doing for years. These are simple, you know, SaaS platforms that any business can have access to for $10 a month.
SaaS being software and as a service.
Right.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that kind of shocks me, just this mistrust that's placed at both at corporate America and at the military for possibly having, you know, useful ideas that can help improve what's happening. Drilling down to kind of a boots on the ground perspective, I think one of the things that frustrates me is that there's this instant fear of what the security situation on the ground is. There's always this assumption made that if it's a country that's, you know, non-Western, civil society is going to be suspended and they're going to be clawing at each other's eyes. In the Philippines, for instance, you know, the health cluster run by the World Health Organization was, you know, directing people to set up these static clinics, you know, at like this community center or this school gymnasium. Well, that's great. But if you had your leg broken in a massive typhoon, you're not going to walk 3 miles to a community center to be seen. And the reason they were directing people to start these static clinics is they could put security at them. And we've always seen that you have to be mobile and move out into the community in order to get them the aid that they need. So the concern should always be there. Don't get me wrong. We're always concerned about safety. But we don't misinterpret desperate, starving people as security threats. We think that they're just simply desperate, starving people.
Now that you are deeply embedded in Team Rubicon and you're back in civil society, how does your experience having been in the Marines and now helping with disaster situations elsewhere impact even just your quotidian life? How often do you use your experiences there as references for the way you go about your day?
Yeah, I find myself doing that all the time. You know, hopefully my wife doesn't listen to this podcast, but I eat, sleep, and breathe, you know, Team Rubicon, except for when I'm with you, Indra. Love you. But, you know, I lean on the things I learned in the military all the time. You know, I have no formal training in entrepreneurship. I have a business degree as an undergrad, but we all know that's kind of a joke. And, you know, the ideas of how to formulate plans and objectives and you know, the, you know, formulating strategy but focusing on tactics. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think the one thing that most Marines, and I can really only speak to the Marine Corps, get out of their service in the Marine Corps is this attitude. this attitude of mission accomplishment and overcoming odds to, you know, to achieve objectives.
You mentioned your wife. She has not been to the places you've been. How often are you referring to your time in the military when you are together, and how does she feel about
it? It's interesting, you know, because of my experiences in the military, I look at things much more objectively. Everyday life situations present themselves. I often can revert to this, you know, perhaps cold calculus of what needs to happen. You know, if you're told in the Marine Corps that you need to storm that trench that has two machine guns in it that's firing at you, you approach that mission with the objective knowledge that you're probably going to lose some men in the attempt. And, you know, in civilian life, we would just say, well, you know what, the trench isn't worth taking. There can be simple things that pop up in life where I my wife tells me I need to look at these much with more subjectivity or empathy, and she'll usually, you know, smack me in the arm and tell me to snap out of it and stop being Sergeant Wood and be Jake. So it happens.
I feel like you're not robotic, but your very tough stance when you first met me has sort of melted away a little bit now. And now I see, oh, this was like Jake pre-military.
Oh, was I Jake when I walked in?
You weren't Jake, but you were no-nonsense Jake. And that's fine. But it's nice to see how your posture has gotten softer over the course of this interview, which is natural in general.
I know it's something I need to work on. I everybody tells me I have a scowl. So I need to work on my scowl. That's what I got in my 360 feedback interviews from people.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Jake Wood. Coming up, we'll meet Skip Bennett, founder of Island Creek Oysters. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the oyster farmer, Skip Bennett. Skip is the founder of Island Creek Oysters, which grows oysters and supplies them to more than 400 chefs across the United States. Restaurants that serve his oysters include Thomas Keller's Per Se and French Laundry, the Eastern Standard in Boston, and the Catbird Seed in Nashville, Tennessee. Island Creek Oysters also operates its own restaurants called the Island Creek Oyster Bar and Row 34 in Boston, Massachusetts. Skip started Island Creek Oysters in Duxbury, Massachusetts in 1990. He sells roughly 120,000 oysters per week, or 5 million oysters per year. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
I'd like to start with understanding how oysters grow.
Where we are, there's no wild oysters, so all of our oysters begin their life in a hatchery. We pick out oysters that have done really well in Duxbury Bay. We bring those in and we spawn them. They're sequential hermaphrodites, meaning that they're either male or female, but they switch back and forth.
Hmm.
So we don't know until they release either eggs or sperm which one they are. And when they start to release, we isolate them and then just add a little bit of sperm and into the eggs, and they start to fertilize right before your eyes.
What do the oysters eat while they're growing?
So they only eat live phytoplankton.
Algae?
It is algae, yeah. In the hatchery, we grow 6 different species of plankton. As soon as we can get them big enough to get them out the door, and we also have to wait until the water's warm enough that there's plankton in the water and that they can survive, and then they're on their own.
How does their shell form? This is made of calcium carbonate.
They get it through the carbon in the water. The more that we can tumble them around, too, just bang them up a little bit in that summer, you can actually get the shell to grow more dense.
So, and what happens if you don't tumble them up a little bit?
They can grow long and thin shells, and really we want an oyster that's pretty compact. You know, maybe 2.5 to 3 inches would be, for me, the ideal oyster, with a really deep cup so that it has a lot of meat inside.
We talk about terroir, which is, you know, the land that wine might grow in. And similarly, you use a term miroir, which is kind of the environment that the oyster grows in.
It is. We select really round oysters, which are maybe a little non-traditional. Our oysters are very fluted, so we select for that. And then there's, you know, the type of plankton that grows in the water and the minerals that are there mm-hmm. that play into the flavor profile.
How would you describe the taste of your oyster?
They change seasonally a little bit, but I always describe them as like super briny up front. And then there's kind of a real vegetal sweetness to them. And I think they finish very buttery.
What is the history of oysters in the United States? How long have people been eating oysters?
Well, I think, you know, probably it goes back to the first settlers, and clearly the Native Americans long before the settlers ate a lot of oysters. And we know that from the shell middens, the piles that were in the Chesapeake and in Maine, these massive piles of ancient shells. Over the years, 100 years ago, it was a big part of our culture. My dad, who grew up in the 40s, remembers having oyster stew every Wednesday night. And it was just because it was such a plentiful source of protein. In the 50s and the 60s, there were two diseases that wiped out kind of the largest populations of oysters in the United States. And that part of our culture was lost.
Why is there now this renaissance of oyster culture in the United States? Why are we seeing it on more menus now?
When I first started selling oysters in Boston, there was just a handful of restaurants that had oysters on the menu. And as we produced more and more, there were more and more restaurants that had it on the menu. And we used to think, wow, aren't we lucky? We kind of caught this while, you know, it's on the rise. But we realized that really what was going on was now that there was a local kind of dependable, high-quality source of oysters, that chefs were more willing to put them on the menu.
So it was you.
It was me and, you know, a handful of other farmers at that time. And now there's a ton of oyster farmers on the East Coast. And it's been the rebirth of this oyster culture. That's pretty interesting.
You talk about how you farm your oysters, but there's this kind of negative connotation attached to farming a bit. And I know you do it in a clean way, but talk to me about that for a moment.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that there is a negative connotation around it, because the crux of the issue is that there are 7 billion people on Earth now and not enough food to go around. You know, shellfish farming is probably one of the most sustainable ways to grow protein, because there's not a lot of inputs. So we're not growing grass to feed animals or growing grains to feed animals, and we're not using fertilizers or water. It's really what the oyster or the shellfish are eating to create the protein is something that's a nuisance to the water.
It is.
Well, the nitrogen causes excessive algal blooms. And when people live and work and farm or around the watershed, the nitrogen leaches into the water and you get excessive algal blooms, which shade out plant life and use up dissolved oxygen. So it really can make an inhospitable environment for fish and shellfish.
So the oysters are natural vacuum cleaners in a way of this nuisance?
They are. They remediate the nitrogen and they're turning the algae into protein, which is amazing.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Skip Bennett, the founder of Island Creek Oysters, a company that harvests oysters and sells them to more than 400 chefs in the United States. Restaurants that serve Island Creek oysters include Shaw's Crab House in Chicago, King's Seafood in Los Angeles, and the Oyster Bar in New York's Grand Central Station. You grew up in Duxbury, Massachusetts, and shell fishing is an important part of your life. Yet, when you graduated from college in 1989, you had a finance degree and you thought you'd work on Wall Street. How come?
You know, it was the 80s, and I loved finance when I was in school, and I had a lot of friends that were in New York. I told everybody I was just going to work on the Bay for one more summer and try to save enough money to buy a suit and get my resume together. And I'm still working on it. So.
How did that not happen?
Well, so in 1989, I was digging mussels in Duxbury, and I loved working outside. I loved the independence of working on the Bay, the physical work. It just suited me. I heard about some guys out on the Cape, way out in Wellfleet, that were growing clams. I thought that sounded kind of interesting. As fishermen, they were barely making grocery money, and that now that they were growing clams, they were all driving around in new trucks and going to Florida for the winter. I thought, what else do I need?
So you discovered these clam producers, and you started then a clam business.
I did. I started a clam farm, and the town of Duxbury was generous enough to license me 3 acres of kind of non-productive areas in the bay. So I got 3 acres and started growing clams. I didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. I couldn't borrow money. I couldn't imagine going to a bank and telling them I was going to borrow money to put clam seed in the bay.
Did you try?
No, I don't think so.
And who was this? This was yourself and who
else? It was really me back in those days, and I was shellfishing. That was where I get the money to buy the clam seed. So it was really hard-earned money, you know, bent over in the mud digging clams to save enough money to buy the clam seed. So that went along pretty well. And each year I started harvesting in 93. So I really rolled that money back into the clam farm. And in 95, I got wiped out by a protozoan parasite. It's specific to clams. It was tough. I really needed to at least try another option.
And this is while your buddies are working in New York in suits on Wall Street.
Yeah, which was probably, you know, in retrospect, being in debt was really hard. And it was really the uncertainty of what I was doing with my life that was the most difficult. At some level, it felt incredibly irresponsible.
Just day to day, even though it was challenging, were you just like existentially feeling fulfilled, or were you more stressed out about the income issue?
Well, I was stressed out about the income, but I had no doubt that's what I was supposed to be doing with my life.
What about your parents? What were they doing?
Well, my dad was a lobsterman, and I think they thought I was crazy.
And your dad also owned a gas station.
He did, yep. Mm-hmm. And I grew up working there as a kid.
So you thought, all right, I'll try oysters on.
Yep.
And there was this farm you discovered in Maine called, appropriately, the Chantelong Farm. How did you come into contact with them?
They had a nursery at Chantelong Farm, which was owned by the Horn family. So they were growing seed up there.
By seed, you mean?
We refer to, you know, baby shellfish as seed. You know, like a half an inch. They were already metamorphosed baby oysters that they had grown all summer long. They were really, really pioneers in figuring out how to grow seed, which really kind of made a match made in heaven where, you know, I bought seed from them, brought it back, and I had pretty good success on the grow outside and kind of struck up a friendship with them. And in 97, their son Christian moved down to Duxbury. He and I really kind of pioneered the grow-out part in Duxbury.
Now, you know, when you say you were the sole fisherman or the sole oyster farmer and now you had this partner, I think of like the old man in the sea alone on the ocean. But what was your social life like at the time?
I was working all the time. And it was really nice to suddenly have somebody that understood. For the most part, when I would talk about what I was doing on the water, people's eyes would glaze over and they really had no idea of what I was talking about. And at that point, I was newly married. I had a little baby, a 96 and 98. Yeah, so I had two. So I was busy.
What is your wife's name?
I'm divorced.
What was
Shannon.
And what did she make of what you were doing?
I think she thought I was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was challenging for both of us.
In 2001, you had a pivot moment that was coincident with September 11th happening. People were no longer wanted to buy, you know, luxury items, which oysters were considered part of. But why did that occurrence actually help your business, ironically?
Well, I had a college friend who was working in high tech. So he was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I was talking with him and complaining about how desperate I was to sell oysters. And he told me about a restaurant in Cambridge called the East Coast Grill. He said that they had oysters on the menu. So I got in my old pickup truck and out of desperation drove up there and I met Chris Schlesinger, the owner of the East Coast Grill. And I didn't know if he'd laugh at me or if they'd kick me out of the restaurant. But he and Eric, his sous chef, they couldn't believe that, A, there was an oyster farmer in Massachusetts, and B, that he was standing in their restaurant. So basically he said, you know, we want to buy all of our oysters from you. On that kind of momentum, I came back and I had a book that somebody had given me. It was the history of oysters. And in the back of the book, there were these famous oyster bars all across the United States. So I was flipping through it, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And the first one I called was a place called Le Bernardin in Manhattan. And I asked to speak to the kitchen, and they asked why. And I told them, and they said, hang on. And I got this guy on the phone. His name was Eric. And I couldn't hardly understand him because of his French accent. And we talked about oysters and oysters in France. And he told me what he wanted for the oysters. So I sent him a sample. He told me he wanted smaller, deeper cup oysters. So again, we kept kind of culling through and found the oysters that he wanted. And we started selling to Eric Repair at Le Bernardin.
Now,
so from there, it was, you know, the Old Ebbitt Grill in Washington, D.C., Water Grill in L.A., Sampson Street Oyster Bar in Philadelphia. We just started hitting all these great old oyster bars. And
so it was ultimately you're getting in your truck and you're going yourself to connect with these chefs directly, such as Eric Repair at Le Bernardin. And Le Bernardin being one of the most prominent seafood restaurants in New York City and the East Coast Grill in Boston, that caused your situation to turn around.
Yeah, and it really, it was the beginning of kind of the model that we built. And in retrospect, it was the beginning of farm to table.
Right.
It was just that our farm was in the water.
How did relationships with, let's say, the French Laundry and Thomas Keller, per se, how did that originate?
Well, that's actually a pretty interesting one. The beginning was that when Thomas opened in New York, he opened per se, they had a fire in the kitchen. You know, they'd spent years building this restaurant, and it must have been devastating for them, you know, for him and also for the staff, but they regrouped after the fire, and Thomas said, I want something good to come out of this. Go out and find cool new products, he told the whole staff. And two chefs, Rory Herman and Chris Lahamadou, found us. After a few years of serving the per se, we reached out to French Laundry, and we were able to, you know, to get into French Laundry as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Skip Bennett, the founder of Island Creek Oysters. Just as Thomas Keller starts off with a fire in his restaurant, you started out with the bay freezing. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so every once in a while, the bay will freeze over completely. And it was an exceptionally cold winter. And the bay froze so solid that we were able to drive trucks out there. So at low tide, we were driving out on the ice and cutting through with chainsaws. The bay ice was about a foot thick. So we knew where the oysters were, and we could pull the oyster bags up through the ice. And it wasn't just per se. It was, you know, we had a whole bunch of restaurants that at that time we felt like we really couldn't let them down.
In addition to having these direct relationships with these chefs, you also sell your oysters online. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, we have this kind of new e-commerce platform that we're developing. We're really excited about it. Late last night, I went back to the hatchery, and I was kind of messing around with some stuff, and I decided to grade one of the silos of seed, and I dumped the seed out on the screen and started washing it through the screen to see how big they were, and I realized that the pile was about 2 million. They were on a 500 micron screen, which makes them like the size of a flake of pepper, barely visible. And for, I've never done this before, but I started thinking about that there were 2 million oysters there, and where would these oysters end up? And it was kind of cool to think, you know, maybe they'll end up at somebody's dinner party in Aspen at Christmas time, or all the, you know, people's homes that they could end up in, and how those people would be excited to get those oysters.
How about the oyster pearls? How does the pearl originate?
So most of the pearls that... The commercial pearls are grown, I think they're freshwater oysters, so they're a different species. Our oysters will make pearls, but they're tiny. All shellfish make pearls or can make pearls. And but all the ones that we found are like the size of a BB, so they're really small. But still kind of neat when you find one. You know, I've found probably two or three in my whole career as an oyster farmer, so... I'd have to be pretty patient to be a pearl farmer.
Have you kept them?
I think, yeah, I have one, and I've given the other ones away.
You mentioned that you like the physical work of being out there. And I think, you know, my being in New York City, I've been thinking lately how we as human beings need physical work. That's what we did on the farms 100 years ago. And all of us here in New York are kind of simulating that physical work in gyms and on exercise bikes. Do you think about that kind of more holistically at all?
Unfortunately, I don't do as much physical work as I used to, but it is really, I think it's important for all of us to not only do physical work, but to be outside and to be in the sun and, you know, just out in the elements. And I think it's really healthy. That's the way we've evolved to be physical and to be outdoors. I think it's pretty unnatural the way that we live now. I was reading something recently on social media that they said that 10,000 year ago, man would have kicked our butts. They were farmers, and they would have to trek out to the fields every day, and the physical work that they did day in and day out would put our running on treadmills and lifting weights to shame.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jessica.
My guest has been Skip Bennett, founder of Island Creek Oysters. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.